you might have an idea and say, this is the best keychain in the world. And I'm going to like make this keychain and start selling this keychain. And then you realize that this is not the keychain that the masses want, or even a small group of people want. And maybe, you know, listen to like what people are looking for in a keychain, that you would have saved time. So I understand now that my job is to listen first and then design programs that respond authentically to those needs. And that's whether it's a school, whether it's a museum or a community space. I think meeting people where they are and elevating their voices is my most favorite part of the process.
You're listening to the Communitas of New York podcast, where we invite you, our business-focused listener, to join us in our strategic focus on business development, specifically with guests who are alumni of the Communitas Ventures Accelerator Program. In our third season, we hold conversations about engagement and community-driven entrepreneurship. Creating positive and hyper-local impact means fostering deep understanding with stakeholders. We invite you to hear entrepreneurs discuss their own experiences with meeting and collaborating with their fellow community members where they are at, developing and serving with carefully designed and innovative solutions. I'm your host, Monique T. Marshall. This is episode 17 with Kamara Lajah of Nature Bella's Kids and Camp Nature Bella.
So my name is Kamara Lajah, and I am with Nature Bella's Kids and Camp Nature Bella.
Kamara, welcome to the Communitas of New York podcast. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Yes, we both are. So before we kick off all the things, if you could just start by sharing a little bit about who you are and tell us about your venture, Nature Bella's Kids and Camp Nature Bella.
Sure. So my name is, like I said, Kamara Lajah. I like to say that my 9-to-5, I was recently promoted to Chief Learning Officer. Congrats. At the Queens Museum, as well as director of the upcoming Children's Museum, the Suna Children's Museum at the Queens Museum. So that's my 9-to-5. I am very much focused on art and education. And then I would say my 5-to-9 venture is really encompassed in Nature Bella's Kids, and Camp Nature Bella is part of that. And it's really about promoting diversity and empowerment for young people and kiddos.
We love that. So can you talk a little bit more about the work that you're currently doing? Because you've also had a couple of shifts that you've made in your company as well.
Yeah. So Nature Bella's Kids came first. It began as my children's book brand. As I mentioned, it celebrates diversity, empowerment, also environmental awareness. And I wanted to create stories where children, specifically children of color, could see themselves reflected as heroes, as leaders. And from there, you know, the stories really came to life and the brand itself started to resonate. I was a teacher at the time and my students really loved it. And Camp Nature Bella was born out of that because I wanted to create a tangible space that created the same kind of diversity and empowerment, kind of a very much a brave space that was able to build confidence and create a space where there's adventure and learning and curiosity. And so that was kind of the second fold under the Nature Bella's Kids umbrella. And recently, like very recently, because of my work in museum education and as an art administrator, I decided to develop a practice where all of these initiatives basically fold into. And it's called Creating the Art of Learning. And it basically connects all of my work in education, in culture, and creativity under one ecosystem that's focused on representation, joy, and belonging.
That's so great. And can you talk about, one, I love the work that you are doing. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs can relate to you're doing so many great things. And for you, you've been able to streamline, as you mentioned. So can you talk a little bit about that decision and how that's kind of been beneficial for you?
Yes. And it's actually through social entrepreneurship venture. You know, one of the things that we do as entrepreneurs is capital makes the dreams become alive and all of our ambitions and goals basically resonate with regards to having the funding to do so. And Camp Nature Bella was always something that I provided seed money for and things like that. And through my I guess my 9-to-5 at the museum and the connections that I made there, I then developed this practice that folds all of these initiatives under more of a consulting umbrella. So it's spending all the time that I did to basically pilot these smaller initiatives while representation and all of the great, beautiful things were at heart. Wanting to scale it, I saw, okay, I need to scale it in a different way. And that is what this transformation of curating the art of learning really came under. But the mission that stands under Camp Nature Bella, Nature Bella's Kids, and wanting to really empower young people, especially young people of color, that still stands. But I think just as an entrepreneur, you have to play around a little bit. You have to kind of test and pilot and play test and prototype and see kind of what works and what fits to make sure that something is really sustainable and it has the longevity to go the distance, really.
Yeah, that's sound advice. And speaking of your background, there are many gaps in terms of education in the arts and even beyond that in our community. So what are some of the examples of the most visible or prevalent instances that you witness these days?
Yeah, I mean, I still think there is a major lack of representation and cultural relevance in arts education specifically, but I definitely think in education as a whole. I mean, it's a time where government is controlling kind of what our teachers and educators are doing in the classroom settings, you know, specifically in public school settings. And so I feel that cultural institutions, museums specifically, they can fill these gaps, right? Where representation, specific histories that are being erased right now can now be upheld and really spotlighted in a way. And I think that we still even have a long way to go when it comes specifically to arts education, that many programs fail to reflect the lived experiences of the children that they actually serve. So I believe that's the connection between underfunding in the arts and the creative learning spaces, but also now political climate that we currently live in. And so my current work is about shifting that focus and making sure that education, specifically arts education, can be culturally sustaining, accessible, and rooted in joy.
Love that. And so with that, you're saying that we still have a ways to go.
In this,
how do you think now still compares to any gaps that you witnessed in the past, say, 1, 2, 3 or more decades ago?
Yeah, I mean, decades ago, the main issue that we were looking at, especially in education, it was really about access, right? It was about making things accessible for various audiences and not really being very specific and calling a thing a thing, right? Really calling it representation or calling it a lack of pedagogy that's connected to maybe social justice or cultural representation. So it was more about just entry points that connected with access. And now I really truly think it's about authenticity. It's about, does this work truly reflect what these environments reflect, meaning the children who are in these classrooms or in these museum education settings, are they there for the programs that are really harnessing, oh, I feel seen and I feel like I belong? And I believe that in the past where it was more technical, like I said, about access, now the huge gap 20, 30 years later, it's moving beyond representation and more around a shared authorship and learning, meaning that our children, our various audiences that we're teaching are the focus of our teaching, you know, should also be part of the conversations as we're creating different curriculums and learning plans.
Yeah, that is a great point. I love that shared authorship and learning. And speaking of authenticity, I want to take a step back because talking about the names and inspiration behind the names of your organizations, each of your organizations, can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so Nature Bella's Kids, that came about in 2018. I just had my daughter and I'm the type of person where I can't sit still. So I stepped away from being a teacher and I always wanted to write children's books. And now that I had my kiddo, it was the perfect time. And so the name behind Nature Bella's Kids came about this idea of it means beautiful nature, and it's really about recognizing the beauty in both the natural world, but in ourselves and in our culture, in our individuality, in our creativity. So that's where Nature Bella's Kids really kind of came about. Having the word kids in the title really anchors the fact that this is a children's brand and the focus is really about youth development. And then Camp Nature Bella came out of that as our first program, and it's not a traditional summer camp. I never really saw it as that, but it was more about that excitement, that anticipation that children have when they're about to go to summer camp and like throughout the school year, they're looking forward to that. I wanted to build different programming where it could be sprinkled throughout the academic year that really has that same energy. So not just about the summer. So that's where Camp Nature Bella kind of came about. And it was really about creating that same joy and excitement that kiddos feel when it's the summertime. And then curating the art of learning, which is the new practice that this all falls under, that came about with this idea of my work that I do in education, but also as a curator in the museum setting. And so this idea of curating the arts of learning, that there's an art that's connected to how we learn and how we receive information, and it's varied, right? Because it's a unique experience for everyone. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the same thing as when we view art. It's a unique experience for everyone. So that's where that title came from, this idea of curating the art of learning, helping schools, museums, and communities build learning environments. So that's where all of the various names of my ventures have come about.
And I love that because it's like, it's so close to home and just a beautiful story, the inspiration and behind your daughter. And I think that is great in that there's that authenticity, and also people see you in what you're doing in your work. Mm-hmm. And that's powerful. And so when you think about the reasons that you founded your venture, now can you talk about, like, if you had to say what this target person or community for whom this program is built for, and the books and the products, who were they created for?
Yes. So the books, the toys, even the program Camp Nature Bella, those were all created literally for, at the time I was a history teacher, mm-hmm. for middle school and elementary school. And I saw the gaps with representation, even like with our own school library. The books did not reflect the children who were reading them. And so that's where the spark of me creating the Nature Bella's Kids book line that came about. And, you know, the images, the illustrations, like all of that was really to reflect mirrored images of my students. And I think my books are for all children because it's not just for Black and Brown children, but the representation that reflects in Black and Brown children reading the books, I think is very exciting. But it's for all children to understand that our world is diverse and beautiful because of the diversity. And Camp Nature Bella specifically was brave space created for young girls, specifically tweens who were at this age where they weren't super young and they weren't ready for like high school age type programming. And I feel like sometimes they're the forgotten age group. Yeah. So Camp Nature Bella was really intentionally for that demographic, that 10 to 13 demographic, just to be a brave space, like I said, that really anchors curiosity, adventure, creativity. And now curating the art of learning, it's for the adults that work in these spaces. It's for folks who work in, whether they're teachers or they work in schools or they're museums, and they're trying to create the programming. Basically, this new practice is bringing all the experience that I have developed over the years in all of these informal and formal settings, and now being able to work with individuals to then create their own programs and to deepen their own connections in the classrooms and outside of the classrooms.
Mm-hmm. And Kamata, what do you say most of the activity for Camp Nature Bella takes place, and what kind of activity is it? Because I love the fact that it's camp throughout the year.
Yes. So a lot of the programming, it happens in whether they're classroom settings or nature settings. So when I say nature, I mean like outdoors. So it's everything from surf lessons at Rockaway Beach to hiking upstate in the Catskills to transforming a school auditorium or a gym into a Zen space with yoga mats and all the things. So it's really taking whatever space we have and making it beautiful. And so when I did Camp Nature Bella programming, it was very much, yes, like we would do things when the weather is nice, we'll do things outside so that there is this connection with nature, whether it's at the beach or it's hiking. But then we also create in person inside arts making spaces, so workshop spaces and things like that. And through the curating the art of learning, the consulting that I'm doing, it's basically doing just that with whatever spaces that my clients have, you know? Mm-hmm. So even if you don't have a huge gym, if you have just a small classroom, how can we transform that into something that is a beautiful space where this type of learning and creativity could really blossom? So I think the twofold is that through my own programming with Camp Nature Bella, it was very much seeing what works, you know, what's tested and tried and true. And now through my consulting services, I'm able to kind of adapt that to what my clients are looking for.
Mm-hmm. That's so great. And so in terms of curating the art of learning, mm-hmm. and these, as you mentioned, are taking place in classrooms, but also museums?
Yes.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about how this process came about and even your process of producing these kind of activations?
Yes. So it literally came just like that. When I was pushing the venture for Camp Nature Bella and looking for funding and resources to really develop and deepen it, but also balancing it. And this is real talk, like as an entrepreneur, yeah. like, you know, balancing it with my 9-to-5, I was like, I can't do both. Like, I'm being stretched in many ways. Then I started to think, okay, my mission, my values, everything that I love about Camp Nature Bella, I want to keep it the same, but I want to make it into a tangible way where I can really do this fully and do it in a way where it's going to have the same impact that I always envisioned that Camp Nature Bella would have. And like I said, through some trial and error, testing different things, I found that consulting was the way to go because I was now being seen in the museum education space, specifically in the art world, as, you know, a person to tap on the shoulder to ask ideas and resources and, hey, you've done this. And then I was like, okay, there's something there. I do have all of these ideas and track record, you know, is strong and things like that. And that's where this idea of developing this into a practice really came about. And that's where that shift happened to, okay, I might not be able to pilot or to have a 9-week program with young girls anymore in a Camp Nature Bella setting the way I've done in the past, but I can now work with a teacher or a youth leader or a museum educator to create something that's similar but reflects their communities and their environment, but still has that same sentiment of working with young girls or non-binary individuals or boys, whoever their audience is. And so that's where this kind of the transition has come about. It went from me actually being a practitioner and having these programs with the young girls and leading Camp Nature Bella to now it really evolving into me being able to help other people, whether they're local or, you know, I've worked with folks in Atlanta. I'm working with a group in Trinidad right now. So I love that I can deepen the reach and the impact, but my mission still stays the same in a way.
Mm-hmm. And when you say that, and just what I'm noticing in a running theme in this conversation, which I think is great, is that you talk about the evolution and being able to shift, but also the mission stays the same at the core. I think for a lot of times as entrepreneurs, sometimes we can get so stuck on the original idea that we don't shift at all. So for you, how did you deal with, okay, this is the time to answer the call to shift?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, and I think being part of Communitas really helped me shape that, because as we're developing our pitch decks and all of the things that come with it, you're really, like you said, you're attached to a specific interpretation of what you think your business is, right? What your venture is. Eat, breathe, you know, sleep it, because it becomes such a big part of the program and you're really going and you're fighting for that. And I think it was post the program and really sitting in everything that I learned, all of the amazing resources that I learned, that I was like, something has to shift, because either I have to like make this my full-time, almost like a nonprofit, and just dive right on in, or how can I still do this and it's sustainable? It's sustainable, but it still has my passion and my ideas and my values at its core. And I think that's when I was like, okay, let me pivot. And when I got my first client and I was able to have that same like energy and joy and excitement that I did for my own programs under Camp Nature Bella, I was like, okay, I have something here. And then hearing their testimony after, like, they piloted those programs and like the feedback they had from their, you know, the kids who went to those programs, that made me see, okay, I don't have to be the person who's actually facilitating the programs. I can be the conduit, like the person in between, helping to shape it from, you know, behind the stage kind of in a way. Mm-hmm. So that's when I realized, okay, you can shapeshift. Your ideas can morph. They should evolve. You know, you should never really be stuck on where you were maybe 3 years ago and what your idea was. Maybe it evolved and now it has like a different component. And so that's why I still say that, you know, Nature Bella's Kids is still the heart of it. Camp Nature Bella is still very much something I'm passionate about. And I don't know, maybe I will start doing Camp Nature Bella programs again. But where I am right now in my career and my life, curating the art of learning is really the conduit to still get. And it's more sustainable, I can say as well. Yeah. Financially, yeah.
For sure. Shout out to Communitas. Always bring the best out of us. Love that. I love that you shared that. So does this shape-shifting and acting as a conduit influence your artistic process? Because you do produce your own coloring books and are a best-selling children's author.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that is why I was so passionate about it, because it was born out of that creativity. It was born out of the conversations I have with my illustrators to make sure that the representation is reflected in a way I want it to. And then having that hands-on creativity in the same way of doing programming versus doing an actual book. I keep the same passion. I'm very much a Virgo. Yes. So I'm also very much with my checklists and making sure that things go in the way that I want to see it. But what I can say through now curating the art of learning and in consulting, there's a point in time where you step back, right? Like you help folks to develop their vision and to develop what they want to produce, but you're not the final say, so to speak, right? You're just there to kind of like be a fairy godmother in a way. And then they have to take it to the next level. So what I've found now is that I am okay with that. Whereas when I was kind of doing everything under my Nature Bella's Kids brand, it has to kind of be my vision. So I think that has been the growth, and that has come with actually curating exhibitions in my 9-to-5 at the museum, working with artists, because you're there to help shepherd what their vision is, right? What they want to kind of produce in the gallery spaces. So in that sense, it's a beautiful blend of how my two worlds have collided and to how I'm now kind of just in the back, kind of steering the ship, but not necessarily like the person who's always in the front facing.
Yeah. That's a great feeling. All the things mesh really well together. You have a beautiful life.
Thank you.
And Kimada, I would love to know more about your artistic process in producing your books. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yes. So growing up, I was very much a reader. I was fortunate to have a father who made sure we drove to, I think there were at the time, there were like two bookstores in Harlem that he would take me to. And we lived in Staten Island at the time. Wow. And so we would schlep all the way to Harlem because he was like, you know, those book fairs that they have at your school or the bookstore that's at the mall, like the characters are cute, but they don't reflect you. Mm-hmm. So he was very much take me to Harlem so that I can really be seen and feel seen. And at the time, at 8, 9, 7, I might not have really like clocked it. But now looking back on it so many years later, I realize how beautiful that was and how it inspired Nature Bella's Kids. And as I mentioned, this was all through all sparking this idea of, one, I was going to become a mama. So this idea of representation for my kid, but also my students, my former students. And so the books that I produce, specifically the picture books, are very much Black and brown characters doing things that you may not necessarily associate with us culturally, right? So the first book is a young girl in Hawaii and she's surfing with her brother and her father. Then the second book is a young Black girl that lives upstate New York in the Catskills on an organic farm with her family, and hiking, skateboarding, all of these things are kind of components of these picture books where Black and brown kids doing regular things, things that you would not blink an eye if another, you know, race or culture was doing. And it was very important for me to just express that type of joy through the books, specifically through the books that I was creating. And then the empowerment series, we have books on affirmations, book on a gratitude journal, things like that. I realized were so important, especially to that tween age that I was teaching at the time in middle school, because they have so many feelings and they don't have many outlets. And so that is where the ideas for many of these books came from. One, wanting me to just show them that there's so much joy to be had in this world, and creating these imaginary scenarios and stories was one way to do it. But then also creating actual tools, journals, planners, where they can really feel the empowerment was very important too. So my creative process is always thinking of the end goal first, like what do I want my reader to see and feel, and then working my way backwards to then develop it.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. And can you remember your first experiences with writing stories?
Wow. Ever since I was a little kid, like probably as soon as I learned to write, I'm also very much a performance person. I'm a theater teacher as well. So would write stories and then act them out. And I would enroll all of my cousins to be part of these stories and costumes and all. And so from a very young age, I came up to New York when I was 6. I grew up in Trinidad. And then so I have like so many memories being in my grandmother's house in her yard. And we're just putting on these shows from stories that I wrote. And so I think from a very young age, I guess I always was a writer. It's just when I had the time to do it, when I stepped away from teaching and I had time on my hands, I was like, okay, this is when I want to finally publish it and get the stories out there.
That is amazing. I feel like we can all relate to that.
Yeah.
The presence involved. I love that. So we talked about your a former history and environmental studies teacher. Mm. These days, you are a director of education and community engagement at the Queens Museum. So how has bringing your education experience into the museum spaces changed your perspective on pedagogy?
Yes, that's a great question. So I am fortunate enough, you know, I've been at the Queens Museum. It's going to be 6 years in January. Yeah. I started literally right before the pandemic, not having an art history background, early a museum background, and coming from, I think having my environmental and history background did help me. And actually, I was seen as a very unique candidate in that sense. And now there's a full circle moment because I am pursuing my doctorate in education and my dissertation is all around culturally sustaining pedagogy in museum settings. So I think having the background that I've had as a history teacher, it has shaped the way that we even develop our museum programming because accessibility, culturally sustaining pedagogy, and social justice are all at the heart of what we do. And it's all rooted and centered around our varied communities. You know, Queens is the most multicultural, diverse city in all of the United States. And so there's so much beauty in that, but there's so much accountability in that because you want folks who come into the museum to feel seen and valued and not one culture really dominating the whole space. And so I take that and my team, awesome team, also, we really take that to heart when we're developing programming and when we're developing different curricula and pedagogy.
That's amazing. And now does your venture offer programs in museums or other cultural spaces in the city?
Yes. So as consultant, I also work with other museums. Right now, like I mentioned, there's a space in Atlanta that we work with. There's a space in Trinidad that we work with. And there is one community in Harlem that we work with as well, a small school that we're developing some programming with. And so it's really nice that a lot of the work that I do in my 9-to-5 can be translated into ideas to help other initiatives and other cultural organizations and schools as well.
And so as an author and leader in museums and communities, you have had to flex your creative and pedagogical muscles. But there is a whole other skill set involved in running a business like yours, of course. So what kind of business knowledge did you have when starting out with your venture?
Oh my gosh, little to none. So, and that's what like Communitas came at such a beautiful time. Everyone thinks, oh, running a business is super easy. You just have to have the ideas. Like that's the easy part, right? Like coming up with the ideas is easy, but actually implementing it and bringing it to fruition is a whole different thing. And I think that's where there's the legal aspects with like, are things trademarked? Are there licenses you need? You know, luckily now we're in our lives where like technology is like very much at our fingertips. So there's ways to find out certain information. But I think when I was first getting started, there were a lot of legal questions that I had that I didn't know. And so Communitas showed me that, you know, you have to have a plan. You know, you have to have a whole business plan. You have to have a budget. You have to have a way that you will be raising money or getting funds in some type of way. And if you're pitching for some types of funding, you have to be able to package this beautiful story of whatever it is that you want to do. So there's a whole marketing aspect that's also connected to it. So I can say that I had little business knowledge when I first kind of started my ventures, doing it very much indie type of way, very much still doing it indie type way. You know, my books are all self-published. I have been approached by bigger traditional publishers, but for right now, I actually am very excited to still self-publish because I've built a brand and a look and a feel. And that is all very like super important to me that I still have very much a say in all of those things. But yeah, I can say that it's very much been a learning a little bit more every day and really having mentors that are in the business world, they have helped me in big ways as well.
Yeah, certainly. And Kamada, what would you say in retrospect do you wish you had known when first starting out in your business?
Ooh, I think first starting out, instead of wanting to do everything myself, I would have accepted help when help was offered. I think for me, it was very much like, you want to kind of prove to people that you can do this, right? You can do it on your own, that your idea was great, that your idea is lucrative, that's sustainable and all these things. And I think it's okay to have a moment where you're prototyping, where you're playtesting, where you're piloting initiatives, you're holding focus groups, or you're testing it on friends and family and getting feedback first before you dive all the way in, if that makes sense. And so I think that I would have spent a little bit more time doing that, kind of getting things a little polished to a certain place. And then I think it would have saved a lot of money and years and heartache. But, you know, I still very much appreciate the journey that I went on because I learned a lot. But I think if I could go back, I may be in a different place than I am now, business-wise. And whether that's better or worse, I don't know, because I am very happy where I am now. But I think I would have taken time to just get feedback from my inner circle a little bit more before I maybe launched certain things.
And speaking of inner circle, so we've been focusing our conversations these days on community-driven entrepreneurship and collaboration with the community. So what does true community education and engagement look like to you when there are disparate needs in communities?
Yeah, I think true engagement isn't really one size fits all. Kind of going back to what I said before, it's all about co-creation and collaboration. I think that's very big in all facets of my work. I believe in, you know, not creating something and it's like, oh, they will come because it's there. It's like, no, you have to engage whoever you want this audience to be, or this person who's buying the book or attending the event. Like, they have to be at the table at some point as you're like developing these things. And that goes back to what I was saying with, you know, piloting or sharing certain ideas before you launch it. So I think true engagement isn't one size fits all. I think every community defines learning differently. So you have to listen and understand what the needs are or what the wants are before you create your thing. Because you might have an idea and say, this is the best keychain in the world, and I'm going to like make this keychain and start selling this keychain. And then you realize that this is not the keychain that the masses want, or even a small group of people want. And maybe, you know, listen to like what people are looking for in a keychain that you would have saved time. So I understand now that my job is to listen first and then design programs that respond authentically to those needs. And that's whether it's a school, whether it's a museum, or a community space. I think meeting people where they are and elevating their voices is my most favorite part of the process. And so that is why curating the Art of Learning kind of came about. Whereas instead of me just creating and pushing things out there and designing things, now I get to work with people and be an active listener as they want to develop things. And I'm finding a lot of joy in that. I mean, I still am creating my books and my toys and all of these things, but being able to kind of spread that knowledge and that excitement now is really at the heart of the work, and that's working in community.
For sure. And how do you stay focused in order to foster true community-wide empowerment through your unique vision?
That's a good question. I think I stay focused by anchoring everything that I value. So creativity, representation, joy, very much, you know, as a mom, as, you know, a senior leader and at work, it's easy to be pulled in many directions. But for me, I return back to the why. I return back to like, what is the reason that I'm doing this work? And that really keeps things very affirmed, and I feel very empowered with that work. And it translates. It's a full circle moment where I get to really feel the joy from doing that type of work. So it's important to really have a mission that keeps you anchored and connected to why you do what you do.
And in what ways do you seek out community collaboration as an entrepreneur and in your capacity as the Director of Education and Community Engagement at the Queens Museum? And also, in what ways does the community seek you out?
So, I mean, a lot of the work that we do, it's anchored in trust and transparency. Like, if we do not have those two things, the programs, the relationships fall flat. The work really starts with relationship building, and that it might take a couple of weeks, it might take a couple of years. And I always say there's a type of emotional labor that's connected to this type of work when you call yourself a community museum or when you're anchored in community type programming. Because it's not just like a hi-bye type thing. It's like, these are people you're going to see again, you're going to connect with again. You want to have longevity in through those relationships. So for me, when I seek out collaboration, it's really starting with simple conversations. Like I said, active listening, I think, is very important, because when people feel seen and not just like, oh, you're just talking to me because it checks some kind of like grant application, I think it's very much that it has to be, the collaboration is not transactional. It's, you know, relational. It's about the relationships that's developed. And I think community, because they've seen, and we have this track record of being like that as an institution, you know, they reach out to us because of that, because of this transparency that we try to offer with all of the collaborations that we do.
Yes. And speaking of building that trust and transparency, how do groups with whom you work sometimes intersect in unexpected ways?
You know, that's some of my favorite moments is when things overlap naturally. You know, a couple of those examples are when our teen program, which is, you know, like very much my other baby, Queens Teens Institute for Art and Social Justice, is one of our big umbrella programs. When a lot of those teen leaders, they do community service hours at the museum throughout different events. So sometimes when you see that interaction with the teens and maybe our seniors who are doing events, and that intergenerational pull and connection is so beautiful, I get so much joy out of that. Because it's very easy for things to be siloed. But when those overlapping conversations happen or those initiatives happen, it's really nice. I also like the idea around when artists and educators kind of come together, because in museum setting, there can be a hierarchy between curators and educators. And I could say that at our museum, we're very much trying to level the playing field in that sense, because we realize how important education is in a museum setting as well as art. So that's really nice when you see like ideas are born through brainstorming sessions with artists and educators and community members. That joy and those conversations and collaborations, that's where this idea of curating the art of learning really came for me, and wanting to build it as an actual thing and as a practice, and not just little conversations I was having siloed, but now under this umbrella of, no, this is the work, and it's what's connected to my dissertation. It's what's connected to everything. So while it sounds like I do a lot, there is a nucleus that they all kind of just connect to. And that's a big part of the work.
Yeah. And do you have any mentors in the community or teachers from whom you've gained inspiration?
Oh my gosh, yes. So I'm the product of two teachers. Both my mom and dad are teachers. Well, my dad's retired now, but my mom is still a first grade teacher. And so she inspires me with everything that she does, because she's still in the classroom setting. So when I'm bouncing ideas off of, oh, we're developing this in the museum and things like that, I can always get feedback from her as a classroom teacher who would be bringing her students to these events. But I also, like when we're developing things for older adults and seniors, although she wouldn't want me to call her a senior yet, you know, she gives me feedback from that. Also, our EDL executive director, Sally Talens, is very much one of my mentors. She trusts me in a way that I don't think a boss has ever done that. And that's why I feel so connected to the work we do at the Queens Museum, because I would just walk into her office with this idea and she'd be like, okay, go ahead, you know, like write it up, get funding, go do. And when you have somebody who sees you in that way, I think is quite amazing. But I am huge when it comes to mentorship, whether it's me being a mentor or, you know, me having mentors, because I think it's reciprocal, right? I feel like you're learning from them, but they are also learning from you. And I think it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I agree. Those people to guide you and also be there to listen when you need them as well.
Exactly.
Yeah. And Kamada, you've also had some major recent big deal things happen. So you were recently awarded the Caribbean Impact Awards in 2025, as well as the Power Player in Education Award in 2023 and 2024. So what do these awards mean to you in terms of your work in the community and also your vision?
I mean, they're beautiful, right? It's beautiful to be seen in that way. Like, you don't do the work for those accolades, but it's nice. And, you know, like, for example, for the Caribbean Impact Award, there was a huge, like, dinner that was part of it. And my aunt, who was visiting from London, my mom, my daughter, my cousins, my brother, sister-in-law, they were all able to like attend the dinner with me. And that was more important to me than the actual award. You know, to be able to have your village see you, be seen by other people, there's nothing like that. And the Power Plays in Education, like that is huge to me, because while I work at an art museum, and it's so beautiful to still be connected back to education, because education is still very much a conduit to the work that I do and my passion. So still being able to elevate education and cultural space, I think that is really beautiful. And to be seen by these bigger entities that are outside of the Queens Museum walls or outside of Nature Bello or anything like that, I think is great. So yeah, it's nice to be valued in that sense.
Yeah, that is amazing. And with all the things that you've accomplished, I'm sure this journey has not been without its challenges. So I want to shift into talking about the challenges, the lessons, and observations. So what are the challenges in trying to first define community?
Yeah, that comes up a lot, especially with this work. So I believe community isn't one group. It's layered and it's seen differently, right? Because you might define community in one way and others might define it differently. I think the challenge is designing programs that speak to all the layers without losing the focus, right? Because if you're trying to please every single person, especially as I mentioned, that the most multicultural diverse city in the country, like we can't highlight every single culture and we can't translate the work into every single language that is housed in Queens type of thing. So it's this idea of, okay, how can we create, even if we do highlight a specific culture, how can we still have entry points where other folks can resonate and understand and find joy or at least find curiosity, right? Like the idea is that every single space you walk into is not going to just reflect you. But if it can at least spark some curiosity, some ideas in your head where you realize, oh, wow, the world is varied and it's different and it's big and it's bold and it's beautiful. I think we're doing our job in that sense too. I've learned to define community is not by demographics, it's by shared values, right? It's by creativity, belonging, and growth. And so when you center that, I think it expands the idea of what community really is.
Mm-hmm. I had to write that one down. Community by shared values. Love that. And so in this process, what have been some of those reality check moments that you faced while guiding your venture?
Yeah, definitely from, what was it, 2 years ago, I was part of the cohort. So pitching Camp Nature Bella at the time till now, I would say the biggest reality check is that passion isn't enough. You know, we were all very passionate about our ventures, but structure matters, right? You have to have a tangible business plan. You have to have a well thought out marketing plan, all the things that come with it. And I think that sometimes we get very caught up in, oh, I have this idea and it's the best thing in the world. And we lead with that. But we don't realize that for something to really be sustainable and long lasting, that they have to have all these other things connected to it, right? So creativity also needs systems that thrive, budgets, timelines, strategy. And as I mentioned, at one point, I tried to do everything myself, but now I know sustainability comes from collaboration and clarity. So yeah, those were definitely some reality checks that have happened.
Mm-hmm. And what about the unexpected challenges when working amongst the community?
I would say managing expectations. You know, everyone wants impact right away, but it takes time. And whether that's your funders or your boss or the community itself, that the impact takes time. And I really make sure that my team feels that too. Like we know that things are not going to happen overnight because then that's how burnout happens, right? Mm-hmm. I also that communities aren't monolithic. You know, and that we have to understand that one family's needs may conflict with another's. So going back to this idea that our communities are varied, slowing down and listening. So going back to this idea of active listening to design with people and not for them. I think that is super important. I've learned that over these past years, it's much better to have them at the table with you designing versus, you know, you just creating something and then expecting folks to just show up. I think those are the two things that I would leave with is cultural humility as well as co-creation, that that is what my work really emphasizes. And that's what helps to keep engagement real.
What have been your most recent triumph or eureka moment, whether it's a revelation or something that like really made you reflect on the way that you guide your venture?
Ooh, that's a good one. I would really say that seeing the families respond to joy with some of the ideas that I have around some upcoming ventures that we have to prototype, the children's museum that we're developing at the Queens Museum, those were exciting moments because they were more ideas that I had like circulating in my head. And when we had some certain focus groups with these families, and I mentioned some of the pilot programs that were coming up, like Eco City Lab, and we have another venture called Prototyping Playground that's going to launch at the museum before the Children's Museum opens. That was very exciting to see that the families and the educators who would have to bring the students, they responded with joy and curiosity. And it reminds me that the work is working. Yeah. There's proof in how we do things at the museum, how we develop things, but then we pitch them to families and focus groups first, and then we kind of go from there with it. So that was, I think, the most recent eureka moment that happened because it happened last week. So it's very much still in my head.
Yes, that's good. And that's also going back to what you're saying, like getting people involved in that co-creation in even the smallest ways as you're building. And so back to some of the practical challenges. So your venture has programs or workshops, and you offer books of various kinds on your website. And you also are now offering reading buddies.
Yes, the reading buddies.
Yeah. So what are the challenges of manufacturing?
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the Reading Buddies are still in pre-order phase because we were, and this is about 3 years now, and it's actually worse now with all the tariffs and all the manufacturing and stuff, because all of the Reading Buddies are being manufactured overseas, but because it's a toy, there are many levels to safety, right? So it's not like when you, let's say, produce a journal and, you know, it's then mass produced or something like that, but because it's a toy, soft toy for a younger age demographic, there are many safety protocols it has to go through. So that has been the biggest challenge. I've also had to switch between, I think I'm on my third manufacturer right now. And so it's tricky and it's tough because, you know, I have so many samples of these Reading Buddies. And as you shift to another evolution of it, you know, something will change. Maybe the hair texture changes or the felt that they use changes, the softness changes. So I think that's the trickiest part. And I personally am not going to put anything out there until I am very much happy. Mm-hmm. One, and it aesthetically looks like how I envisioned, but also that it goes through all the safety measures. So that's the trickiest part because there's so much financial strain that happens when you're developing things in a prototyping phase because it's hit or miss, right? And you have to wait weeks, if not months, until you do get the samples. And then when you get them, there's something wrong. So then you have to go back to the drawing board type of thing and then go through the whole process again. So for me, finding a manufacturer that's closer to home is probably the biggest thing that I'm working on right now. But it's also, you know, it's a catch 22 because it also, they're closer to home. They tend to be a little bit more expensive. So that's the biggest challenge that I'm going through right now.
Yeah, I can imagine. And so with this, because you have the product side and you also have the services side, do you feel like you have to put on a different mindset as an entrepreneur when you start to think about manufacturing products as opposed to think about offering services?
100%. That's a beautiful way that you said it. So it's the product side as an author, as, you know, creating these. But what I can say with those on that side is that there are many other people that you have to rely on, right? So whether it's the illustrator or whether it's the manufacturing company or the delivery service or whatever it is, there's so many other entities that's connected to when I am developing a product and I'm putting it out there. And then with regards to the services side, it's very different. Offering my consulting services, I can, you know, have a call right now. I can basically put my services hat on and it's very different because I am giving the information and I'm working with the client and we're developing something together. So it's done in a very different way. And I think for me, that is where, you know, it was in the frustration on the services side, but it's this idea of wanting to be able to have a specific type of impact and realizing that through services, you can do it in a more efficient and cost-effective way. But I would never turn my back on the product side because I find a lot of joy out of that as well. So it's really about balancing the two.
Yeah. Some people can say either or. And so for you, you're saying the balance and they have those benefits, which you like as well.
Yeah, because I think they feed into each other. You know, I think when I'm offering a service to have tangible books or product to show, it's a great thing. And there's a trust factor there, like, oh, well, this person has gone through this, so they can help me with this. And vice versa, you know, going through the manufacturing, the writing phases, all of these things, I've been there. So I can now help the next person who wants to kind of go down that route and show them the tips, the pros and the cons of doing things a certain way. So for me, they feed into each other, but it's two different mindsets for both.
Yeah. And now I want to shift into the roles of Communitas in collaborating because we've mentioned Communitas of New York a handful of times.
Oh, yeah.
And well, Communitas. And we're on the Communitas of New York podcast. So you were a member of Communitas Ventures Accelerator Program.
Yes.
Can you say a little bit about your experience with Communitas America?
Yes. So Communitas America was my first real entry into social entrepreneurship and what that looks like and feels like. You know, it gave me the tools to turn a passion project at the time, Camp Nature Bella, into a structured, more mission-driven venture. I would say that the workshops really helped me think like being able to measure impact, to pitch ideas, to build sustainability. These were all different themes for different workshops that we had. So I really was able to think like a strategist. And I think that was really amazing. Like it really has changed the way that even I work at the Queen's Museum. Like, it was able to give me the tools for that. And even though I didn't receive the seed funding, the experience really shaped how I lead. And this idea of balancing purpose with process, I would say, it taught me that not every no means to stop, but it sometimes means to pivot and evolve. And that is what happened, you know, about a year after I completed Communitas. That's where this idea of curating the art of learning came today. And so that is the mind shift that happened. But like I said, the mission doesn't change and the core values doesn't change.
Mm-hmm. And since going through the Ventures Accelerator program, have you been able to intersect community or perhaps at Communitas Hayground Harlem incubator space with Ventures alumni? Hayground Harlem is an incubated space for community-driven entrepreneurs and partners dedicated to innovation and collaboration.
Yeah, I've stayed in touch with the different alumni. Michelle Licia Joy, who has Stapledon Arts, actually came and did some art workshops at the Queen's Museum.
You can hear Shalicia Joy, Communitas Ventures alumna and founder of Stapledon Arts, in conversation on season one of Communitas of New York.
And we also bought some supplies and we have them in our studios. So that connection has really been amazing. And, you know, there's some other alum that I have on my list of people that I really want to connect with. You were one of them. So this is great. Having this conversation with you. So yeah, it's really beautiful that after you complete the program, there's still so many resources that's connected to the network of the alum that now belong to Communitas. And Hayground Harlem, I mean, oh my gosh, such a beautiful space. Whether you want to have events or anything there. So I think just, you know, being part of the Communitas community is just a really beautiful thing.
Yes, for sure. And now let's talk about the future. So how do you measure progress internally? In your estimation, what is a good measure of impact?
Ooh, that's a good one. So how do I measure progress internally? For me, progress isn't just about outcomes. I really push alignment, like in every facet of my life, whether it's personal or professional. And I realize also the power of the word no. So for me, I tend to first ask, are my projects still rooted in equity, creativity, representation, joy, those types of things? And when I kind of go down the checklist that it still does that, then I'm like, okay, we're still full steam ahead. And it's really about deepening what I have been doing. I also measure internally with regards to, can I track my data both by numbers, like, you know, whether it's participation numbers or whether it's like how many books I'm selling or how many clients I have? Or on the flip side, with regards to working at the museum, you know, participation numbers in our programming and things like that. So yes, there's still that. But then there's the idea of measuring internally with like the heartbeat, like were people like, did they have joy? Did they smile? Did they say they can't wait to come back? Same thing with the books. Like when I see kiddos like smiling, like, oh my gosh, you're that author. Because I've done like, you know, school trips and things like that, where I would go to the schools and I would read the books. So internally, it's not just about hitting certain goals and certain numbers, although, you know, as a business owner, you should be about that, you know, for it to be sustainable. But it's also about the joy that you have when you're creating whatever it is, whether it's a product or whether it's a service.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And I feel like even when you were speaking earlier about the things that you've learned throughout the business process and even coming into Communitas, it's, you know how to make that work in terms of impact, like making sure the joy is there, measuring the joy. So yeah, I love that. And so what's next for you in all of your capacities?
Whew, okay. So so for my 9-to-5, as I mentioned, I literally just was promoted. So all of my work as director of education and community engagement now falls under my new C-suite title, which is Chief Learning Officer at the Queen's Museum. And I also have the official title of the director of the Suna Children's Museum. So that's the new children's museum we're developing from scratch that will hopefully open in 2028. So I basically wear two very big hats at the Queen's Museum, handling all the different programming at the museum, whether it's public programs, education, cultural events, community partnerships. I have an amazing team that helps to execute all that. I also mentioned that I am in school right now, so I am pursuing my doctorate in educational leadership and organizational innovation. So I am now in year two, and I'm preparing to really dive deep into my dissertation. But the beautiful thing about my dissertation, it's connected to culturally sustaining pedagogy in children's museum settings. So here I am developing a children's museum. So So it's all connected. And then with regards to curating the art of learning, it's really pushing it out there, developing, you know, new partnerships, hopefully acquiring new clients so I can work on really cool projects with them. I have the Nature Bellas Kids. I just launched my fifth book under the multicultural series, and I have one launching next week, which is the Halloween. Our new Halloween book is coming out. So there's so many things that's happening. It's all really beautiful. It's the time of year where things really ramp up. And so, yeah, just very excited about all that's to come.
Yes. And speaking of all that's to come, so this conversation, like I kind of mentioned before, it has really for me stood out in how aligned all of the things that you do are. And I think that if someone were listening initially, they would be like, oh, dang, she does a lot. But when we've gone through this conversation, it's like it all made sense. So that there is that balance there. I have a question in terms of how do you handle the balance? And then also, what do you think has attributed to your alignment in all of your areas?
Ooh, that's a good one. Yes. So, and I've heard this many times before, like, wow, you're doing a lot. But like I said, there's that nucleus where everything kind of just gravitates back towards and it's all connected to it. So for me, the balance and the alignment, I am one of those people where I love my downtime. I love to rest like the next person. There are many things that I want to achieve in my life. And so my goals are all big picture. But when there are moments when I'm like, oh, there's an alignment there. So for one example, last year when I applied for grad school to go back to do my doctorate, it happened within like 3 weeks after I had a conversation with an admissions counselor. And I was like, oh yeah, I'll pursue this in like 2-3 years kind of thing. And they was like, oh, but you're doing all this wonderful research for the Children's Museum now. And you're saying you want that to be connected to your dissertation. So that is where the alignment for that came. Like if I was in a program for biology, then I would say, yeah, I have a lot on my plate because it's two completely different worlds. Mm-hmm. Whereas museum education, the cultural space, you know, my writing of the children's books, developing the children's museum, all the things, they're all very much connected. And I think for anyone, when you feel like, okay, you have many branches sticking out, but for you, the trunk is still strong, right? Like it's all connected. Then follow what you want to do. For the outside world, it might seem like, oh, they're doing too much, but it's really about balance. It's about the alignment, connecting it. I don't know how to explain it in a tangible way. For me, it's never been something that I can quantify, but it's a feeling that I've had. And thus far, it's worked for me. So you know when you have too much on your plate and you've bitten off more than you can chew. And I can say I've had to remove certain things in order for what I have on my plate now to work. So yes, there is that. I just don't say yes to everything and I do everything. You know when you have to take certain things off to make space for what really makes sense for you.
Yes, and we felt it. So that was a perfect question for you. And I do want to ask one more piece of advice. So if you could give any advice to an entrepreneur who's just starting out in their journey and those who are passionate about education, the arts, and empowering community, what would you tell them?
Lead with purpose. Lead with purpose, but build with structure. So like I said, your passion, your purpose will get you out the gate. It will get you to a certain point. But then at some point, you do have to build structure. And I would say, you know, another piece of advice would be don't wait for permission or perfect timing. Like start where you are. And if that means piloting or prototyping or, you know, doing something in a small capacity, that's fine. Just start, right? And once you start, you could start building and growing from there.
Great advice. Kimada, where can people find you, connect with you, and support with you?
Yeah, so I am a big LinkedIn girly. You would find all my professional things there. You can find me, you know, Kimada Lajat on LinkedIn. I also am very big on Instagram. So Nature Bellas Kids is on Instagram and you can find the information there. I am now developing my curating the Art of Learning Instagram page. So there'll be more information there that I'm excited to share over the next couple of weeks. So social media is definitely the way to go. And then my books can be found on naturebellaskids.com, on Amazon as well as barnesandnobles.com too.
Perfect. We'll be sure to put that information in our show notes. And we can't thank you enough for being on the Communitas of New York podcast. I am not joking when I say this has been such a powerful conversation.
Oh, thank you.
We just appreciate you for being here doing the work that you're doing. So thank you for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Visit our website for more information about this and all of our shows. You can find that as well as information about the entrepreneurs and conversation in the show notes. Thank you for listening and see you soon. My name is Monique T. Marshall and this is Communitas of New York. Season 3 is produced by Simone Jean and David Michael D. Gregoria.